The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
In a moment of protective movements, you need more disclosure around what your actions are going to be. There's a lot of stakeholders involved, specifically the military, you know, local police and first responders to be able to move the president here today. So intent, like we're not gonna find criminal intent on a text message of something when to execute on that, I'm reliant upon all of these other individuals. But again, we don't know. Right? Because we don't have these text messages. And that's the problem. If we're unable to resolve this issue, we're going to have this credibility issue dangling out there for a long time for the service.
I'm David Preece, publisher of Lawfare. And this is the Lawfare podcast for July 27th, 2022. The United States Secret Service is in the spotlight once again, this time because of deleted texts for the time surrounding January 6th, 2021, and the organization is reeling. To discuss it, I sat down in the virtual jungle studio with Juliette Kayem, formerly Assistant Secretary for Intergovernmental Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security, who has served on the DHS Homeland Security Advisory Committee and has written the book The Devil Never Sleeps, and also with Jonathan Wackrow, Chief Operating Officer of Teneo Risk, who was a long-serving special agent in the Secret Service, including in the Presidential Protection Division. We talked about the use of phones on that job. We talked about the loss of trust and confidence in the Secret Service and its mismanagement of the crisis. We talked about the performance of the Vice President's protection detail on that day, and we talked about the Secret Service's status within DHS and the prospect for a Department of Justice investigation of the service. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 27th, The Secret Service Text Crisis. Juliet, set the table for us here. What do we actually know about the Secret Service texts on or around January 6th and what they did with them?
Here's what we think we know, but the story keeps changing. That let me give the Secret Service the benefit of the doubt and then put holes into it. So the Secret Service, we learned, went through a system instrument upgrade over the course of the period leading to an inauguration. So in and of itself, one could ask, why are they doing this at sort of one of the most sensitive security times? But even giving them the benefit of the doubt, agents were notified to preserve all information on old phones as they were upgraded to new phones or new systems or whatever it is, right? So the entire new network. That did not happen. And that included the dates January 5th and 6th, which are, at least according to the Secret Service, all but one of the texts of the relevant agents is lost.
And do we know from the reporting so far if these refer to government devices or personal devices or both?
Both. I mean, well, they shouldn't be doing any work on personal devices, but and John can talk more about this, but is often the case when you enter government service, the line between the two can often merge. But this would be the government ones and not the personal ones. But like, for example, when one goes into a SCIF or for any reasons, you give up both your personal phone and your work phone. Like nothing is accessible or available. So, but there's a merging of it. Everyone understands that because it's just easier to have one phone over two. So this is their story. They're coming on the Secret Service's story. They're coming on strong with it. This is a story that was known to the Inspector General, a controversial figure in and of himself for several months, but finally is disclosed to the January 6th committee investigating this time period relatively recently. So this is a story that standing alone seems suspicious, but it's not standing alone. And that's what's very important about this story. It is standing in the midst of a series of missteps, of which the Secret Service essentially is not fessed up to what happened on January 5th and 6th. Seems to be protecting a person, Donald Trump, and not a process, which is the peaceful transition of power. This includes, of course, what happened in the car that Ms. Hutchinson testified about. This includes what was going on with his deputy chief of staff, who was a Secret Service agent who seems to have sort of become full-on MAGA and now is returned to the Secret Service. It's just in the context of an overall series of incidents of which the Secret Service is spending a lot of time saying what isn't true. But every time they try to say what is true, here's right. what happened, it doesn't sound plausible. It's implausible that period is the period in which everything is lost.
Yeah, we've got a lot of issues there. We've got the issue of what texts are there and were they proper to be texting certain things. We've got issues of the retention and the upgrade at the time. We've got the issue of failing to notify Congress for months about a deleted series of texts. And then we've got some related issues that have to do with the policy implications. So John, let me turn to you to start tackling some of those. Let's go back to the day. We've talked many times before about some harrowing days you were on duty in the Secret Service. Were you texting as a means of communicating with your colleagues and or others about the events of your work duty on a regular basis?
So I'm going to date myself a little bit, David.
Should I say, were you using the telegraph back then when you were an agent?
Exactly. Texting as a means of communication really in 2014 for us in the service was more limited. I mean, I didn't have a personal phone back then. I had a work phone and that was it. That's all I had. So everything I did was official on my government email or telephone. But the primary means of communication while you're doing protection back then, and it should be today, is the radio, right? That direct point-to-point communication. Now, I think, you know, because of digital enhancements, social media, all of these other now new influences and really distractions, I'll call them, for the service, people are texting. They're texting on personal phones. They're utilizing other apps such as whether it's a Signal, WhatsApp, other communication platforms to engage. I mean, that's becoming the norm. But again, it's not right. And I think that, you know, what we're seeing with the Secret Service today is an agency that really is in turmoil. And as Juliet was just talking, I'm thinking about, well, what's facing the service today, right? We have missing text messages. We have outstanding issues in questions surrounding, you know, what was Tony Honorato's responsibilities as a deputy chief of staff versus his responsibility as a assistant deputy director of the U.S. Secret Service. We have, you know, questions from testimony around what did the agents do with the vice president during the certification as the insurrectionists, you know, stormed the Capitol, what type of action they were taking. And then there are other things that are, you know, related. There were bombs that were placed near the DNC or a bomb, an explosive device by the DNC. Why didn't the Secret Service catch that? Why was, you know, the VP-elect allowed to, you know, be in that environment? So there's just all of these unresolved issues that, absent of clarity, are just, you know, metastasizing into a real negative story about the Secret Service. And the chapeau on top of all of this is that the director has announced that he is retiring, moving on, but now you're going to have this vacuum of leadership. And who's driving resolution and adjudication of these matters, which are so critical? This isn't a minor issue, right? Text messages of January 6th missing that are focused on 10 key agents involved with either the president or vice president, they could have material impact to the overall investigation. The question about, you know, Tony's position as a deputy chief of staff, what type of conversations and insights was he either giving or influencing to change the course that day? Again, those are critical and they remain unresolved. So I think that the service, and I've said this publicly, they need to stop with the drip, drip, drip of information, and they need to just rip the Band-Aid off and give full disclosure, timelines, detail, whether or not it was appropriate or there was some sort of error made. They have to get in front of all of these issues for clarity, so we can start addressing each of these matters individually and then collectively try to clear, you know, the service's name. Because right now, all that's happening is it's complicating matters for them, where their credibility is being eviscerated in front of us. And I said yesterday, I think that that credibility issue is going to have a longer term impact. Remember, Secret Service is a law enforcement entity. They bring criminal cases against individuals for violation of U.S. code. How can you have a law enforcement agency that has so many credibility issues, you know, perceived credibility issues, at the same time that they're trying to prosecute, along with the U.S. Attorney's Office, individuals that have violated the code? So there's a lot at stake right now for the Secret Service.
There is. And you raise a lot of issues that I do want to break down. But Juliet, I want to turn to you on one specific aspect of uncovering all of this, because John mentions, you know, the Secret Service should be more forthcoming by itself and put all the information out there instead of the drip, drip, drip. That's one method.
Yeah.
Another method is investigation, and that can come in multiple flavors. One flavor is media, right? The media getting sources and reporting on it, as we've seen from the Washington Post and CNN and other sources. There also, of course, is the January 6th committee itself and other vehicles of Congress. But there's also the Department of Homeland Security, within which the Secret Service falls, and the Office of Inspector General. You've worked within the Department of Homeland Security. You've been on the advisory board. Talk a little bit about the DHS process for investigating the Secret Service. And given that the Secret Service is unique in so many ways, how do you feel about the ability of the DHS IG to investigate this issue and make its results known to the public?
So I have a strong belief that the Secret Service isn't that special. And they're making us think they're that special because they have this super squirrely and very important job. But there's lots of agencies in the government that have very important jobs. And this sort of hands-off attitude towards them makes it almost impossible to you know, take a step back, which is what I do and what I advise, take a step back and just say, okay, it's just an agency. And their righteousness, and I sound a little bit annoyed because their righteousness about pushing back against what are fair questions about their role, their efforts, their management, their transparency, strike me as something that the Secretary of Homeland Security needs to get a handle on very, very quickly. Secretary Mayorkas has been relatively quiet. And that, you know, you both are beasts of DC as well. That also strikes me as telling that DHS is not buying the Secret Service's story either. He does not want to get his hands on it in some ways. So what I would do is, you do the leadership vacuum, which with John was talking about, is also an opportunity. You need to get someone in here who's not from the agency. This is what people like me recommend when there's an agency in crisis. Get someone there who is competent, but can bang heads, show some greater transparency, some greater humility by the agency, and then basically split the mission at this stage. One of them is to do a deep dive into what happened and be more transparent and report directly to the secretary. In that regard, you don't need to stick an IG in the middle of it, especially this IG who's a Trump holdover and has possibly protected the agency, both protected and undermined the agency. He's sort of hard to read at times. And then the second is, then you focus the 98% of agents, 99% of agents who aren't in the middle of this crisis, to get them to focus on their core and valuable mission. And that's what I would do at this stage. It's the only way to fix it. You, if they pick from within the agency, they are doomed. Honestly, there's just no way that you can do this with someone who has risen up the agency. I don't know how Jonathan feels about that, but I feel pretty strongly.
Well, you know, Juliet, that's a great point. I just want to take a step back and like all these things that we're discussing with the Secret Service today and the issues that they're facing really amount to an existential crisis for the organization. And, you know, in crisis management, that's what I do as my day job. We always have a saying that says, do no harm, right? In the moments of a crisis, do no harm. Resolve what you have. And what we've seen is that they're continuously having these self-inflicted wounds, one, either by the issue initially or how they're resolving that issue. And that leads into the leadership question, which is, who is going to be the right steward for the Secret Service moving forward? And I agree with you, Juliet. I think that at this moment in time, because this is a real seminal moment for the agency to right itself, but you can't do it from the inside. There's too many institutional biases of individuals that you know, have come up either you know following leadership of one individual or the other. I think that you have to step outside of the Secret Service, get a fresh perspective of how to lead an agency that has a very unique dual mission in modern time, right? Like with all of these influences of, you know, political oversight, integration into DHS, collaboration with other law enforcement entities, I think that you have to get somebody that's going to think a little bit differently and not follow the same model that they've been, you know, operating off of for many years. And if there's any time to really, you know, focus on that, you know, significant shift, it's today.
And John, you mentioned something that I want to dig into here, which is that dual mission. So you've got the obvious protection issues that have been uncovered by the January 6th committee and were evident even before then. But of course, part of the reason that this scandal, I'll call it, is so rich is because of what people like Paul Rosenzweig have pointed out, which is you have the Secret Service, which has some cybersecurity and hacking responsibilities within the US government. And it has a system by which text messages are deleted and cannot be retrieved. That is at best disturbing about the capabilities of this organization that is supposed to be using such tools and techniques against the bad guys. But also, why would they put themselves in a position to do that, as Juliet mentioned at the top, at a time when there was such intense interest of what was going on? So what do you think about that? Because one of the most common themes that comes out when you talk to people about the challenges of the Secret Service is, in a sense, the mission creep, the fact that there's too much going on. It's hard to focus on protection as a leader of the organization when you're also worried about money laundering, and you're also worried about cyber issues, and you're also worried about national security events that have been designated as such. Do you think that Secret Service has a, what I would call a credibility problem when it comes to some of these investigatory aspects of its work?
Listen, from an investigative standpoint, the complex electronic crimes investigations that you know the service undertakes, I really do believe that through the Electronic Crimes Task Force and you know other aspects of the Office of Investigations, they have really phenomenal criminal investigators that focus on that. But the key word there is they need the time to focus on those very complex crimes. Having a dual mission is very unique for the Secret Service. It's actually you know something that's you know very appealing to many, is having the opportunity to work criminal investigations and focus on high-level protection. But you know I've said in the past, you know, with all of these mounting challenges that the service faces on the protection side, right? And when I talk about challenges, I'm talking about the challenge of a very dynamic, unpredictable threat environment that they need to outpace, coupled with the complexities of electronic crimes and fraudulent schemes today. The Secret Service is at a point where they have to decide what they want to be when they grow up, right? Like they have to decide, what does that future look like? Now, there are really two camps right now within the agency of people who say, no, we need to focus on one thing and do one thing really, really well. And there's others that want to hold on to those legacy investigative responsibilities. But to me, that's just looking holding on to the past, not looking to the future. And today, again, I go back to the credibility issue, the mounting problems. I think it's a moment that they have to seriously consider moving forward, either eliminating their criminal investigatory remit or start to downsize that or de-scope it to align to their protective missions. But I think that, again, this comes back to leadership, stewardship, and strategy that the service needs to focus on moving forward.
Juliet, what are your thoughts on this part?
So first of all, it's hilarious. You know, John and I actually work together on a bunch of projects. But so what's hilarious about it is if you just take the aura of Secret Service out of it, and let's just call it, you know, the widget service, the answer is so obvious, right? I mean, in other words, exactly what John's saying. And that they don't see it is so painful, but also kind of nerve-wracking because they do have an important mission, which is we know how this unfolds, right? The top leadership, I'm totally honest about it. I have a game that I play, which is how long will the CEO last? Because CEOs of companies in crisis always think they're going to last. And almost all the time they don't, you know, like, you know, the head of Boeing or the head of BP, you know, I'm the one who's going to get the company through it. Right, and then they're gone after a couple months. So look, these people have big responsibilities, and if they fail, they don't deserve to keep the jobs. And so it's nothing personal. So this is, you know, so I know how this unfolds. It's going to get worse. There are going to be malfeasance is going to be proven, not nonfeasance. It's just too coincidental that it's these agents on these days. There's going to be a mutiny within the Secret Service, mark my words, because let's not forget it's Secret Service agents that were put at risk on January 6th, in particular Vice President Pence's detail, which we heard the fear, you know, whether they were calling home to say goodbye to family members, who knows, whether that wasn't hoopla, but they clearly, you could hear the concern in their voices about protecting number two and let alone number three. So there's going to be a mutiny about, you know, why is the leadership protecting these jerks who are protecting Trump and not the 95% of the agents who could care less the politics of the person that they're training. So anyway, so that this is how it's going to unfold. So, you know, and it's just important to say that because, God, we could put them out of their misery so early. I really do think this is going to require a much greater oversight by the department, which has been relatively quiet to date. I don't think that that's sustainable. I just don't. I think this is an opportunity for the department and for the secretary to say enough is enough. You know, you guys just, you're in the widget industry, right? Stop, take the aura out of it, and we can protect the core mission while we also fix what is going on, because this is all going to come out. It's too obvious that it's all going to come out.
Let me ask about one specific issue, and John, I'll turn to you for this one, is we did have a response to a media inquiry from the chief of communications at the U.S. Secret Service. This weekend, he responded, I think it was to Lawrence O'Donnell, and this was his message. The only text messages on Director Murray's phone on January 5th and 6th were notifications from his alarm company at his residence. By policy, Secret Service employees are not to conduct official government business via text for information security purposes as well as government record retention. That seems to be a version of giving the Heisman to the press saying, well, there aren't any messages to see here anyway because Secret Service employees aren't supposed to be texting official business. So the reason that they're not saying this, but the implication is the reason that there was a non-responsive search and we're not getting results isn't really because of a migration and a deletion of texts. There's really nothing to see here anyway. What do you make of that? And is this moving the ball forward at all, or is this making it even more difficult?
It goes back to my statement. In a crisis, you know, objective number one is to do no harm. And what we're seeing is by those types of non-statement statements, it's further pushing the media and the public to, you know, to question what the heck is going on over there. And this is where I say you have to come out and be fully transparent, one, as to what happened. So I think you have to think back. All of this started, this text message disclosure started, not because the inspector general did such a great job and found that the Secret Service didn't have these text messages. Actually, the Secret Service self-disclosed the fact that there were messages missing. So I'm going to give them credit on that side. But from there, the process to resolve those missing text messages is really unclear. What type of, you know, forensic investigations did they do? We've had some broad statements from the Secret Service saying that they're taking, you know, all means to recover, you know, said messages. But what exactly does that mean? Has every single owner of those phones sat down and provided a written sworn affidavit that they did or did not text on January 5th or 6th? We don't know the scope also beyond the 10 that are targeted or under the focus of the inspector general. We don't know if it's hundreds of others of agents and officers around the country, or is it just that 10? Like, again, the scope, the size, and really the impact of these missing text messages, do they impact ongoing criminal investigations? Do they impact other protective missions? So I think that there, you know, every statement that comes out, there's an order of consequence of more questions that need to be answered. And this is where I say that the service needs to take pause. They need to run a full TikTok going back to, you know, when this project started, clear timelines, discuss what data was lost, why it was lost. They need to be accountable for any type of violation of the, you know, Federal Records Act, any other type of regulatory oversight in terms of, you know, information preservation, and fully disclose to the public what happened. Now, David, here's the challenge of all of that. The Inspector General launched a criminal investigation into the Secret Service. This is going to make matters a lot worse. His investigation into the Secret Service is focused on the collection and preservation of evidence. Criminal investigation. That means the Secret Service as a target organization are pencils down on their own internal investigation. So they are no longer doing these forensic investigations. They are no longer trying to seek out affidavits or investigate this internally. That matter, for all intents and purposes, is closed. So that cooperation internally isn't happening. Now the question is shifts to the Inspector General. Does the Inspector General for the Department of Homeland Security have the ability to investigate this incident? I say no. Why? Because it's going to be highly sophisticated in terms of, you know, electronic forensic investigations. I think that coupled with, you know, some potential conflicts that the IG has being part of the same department, I think that this should shift over to the Department of Justice, at, you know, just to make sure that these critical items are addressed.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here.
want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
Juliet, I want to come to you on some of those issues, but first, John, to follow up on that, what do you think is the worst case scenario when it comes to the content of these text messages? Let's put ourselves in a future alternate timeline where we actually do have these text messages. Do you think that Secret Service agents were actually texting things with criminal culpability on January 6th, things related either to the attack on the Capitol itself or about how to manipulate the situation? Because that does seem out of character with what people do in a crisis situation. When you're on the radio, you're focused on the mission, you're not pulling out your cell phone while you're driving or while you're serving on the protective detail. What is that worst case scenario?
Well, the worst case scenario is exactly as you described, that, you know, criminal acts were engaged in by the Secret Service and Secret Service agents. But I hope not, right? I would think that the agency and those agents are better than engaging in that type of criminal activity. I find it very hard to believe, and this is my personal opinion, that we're going to find a smoking gun in these text messages. I think the text messages have been indicative of a larger problem of the Secret Service around transparency and accountability. But, you know, some information will be gleaned from it, but you're not going to get messages that say, okay, you know, we're going to, you know, this is our decision. We're going to do X and we're going to take the president to the Capitol. I just don't think you're going to have that. And the reason being is that in a moment of protective movements, you need more disclosure around what your actions are going to be. There's a lot of stakeholders involved, specifically the military, you know, local police and first responders to be able to move the president here to there. So intent, like we're not going to find criminal intent on a text message of something when to execute on that, I'm reliant upon all of these other individuals. But again, we don't know, right? Because we don't have these text messages. And that's the problem. If we're unable to resolve this issue, then we're going to have these, we're going to have this credibility issue dangling out there for a long time for the service.
Yeah.
Yeah. Juliet, I'd like you to respond to several of those points, but most particularly the call for the Department of Justice to, in a sense, supersede the DHS IG on this.
I think that's right. I think, I mean, you know, whether it's a special investigator brought in to work with new leadership at the Secret Service or DOJ or even Treasury, you can imagine, which used to oversee Secret Service and has some sense of their mission. I think it, this is exactly right. There's no reason to give the Secret Service the benefit of the doubt now. They've lost that. And, you know, I mean, it's, this is the thing. It's like, I, literally, if it were a wig, you know, a widget-making agency, we would not be thinking about this as hard. It would be so obvious to us what needs to get done. Something is terribly wrong. And at best, it's, as I said, at best, it's nonfeasance. At worst, it's real bad malfeasance, kind of scary stuff. And we got to, you're not going to move forward. You're just going to be doing more band-aids. And I think that's the position that the Secret Service is finding itself in. It tries to put a band-aid on. Well, it turns out that the cut is deeper than they thought and or deeper than they want us to believe. And then more stuff, you know, you need another Band-Aid. And this is where their comm strategy is really just honestly pissing me off. Like, you know, it's one thing to be righteous when you know that you're right. It's another thing to be righteous when you know that you're wrong. Like, you know, like, and they know that they're wrong. And so I don't like righteousness in a spokesperson in any regard, but that's my takeaway. So I think that Jonathan is exactly right. And I think one of the things that's interesting to me on this investigation side is I think that this disclosure of the one single text, people who are following along know that the January 6th committee only got one text from this time period. I think that that actually is really damning to the Secret Service in the sense that you really could not call this a technology upgrade flaw, that technology is not that chiseled. It's not, I mean, you're either moving the network or I'm making whatever happened up, but like you're either moving the platform or you're not. So the single remaining text, I think, is actually more harmful in their narrative, right? You're either going to lose them all or you're not going to lose them all. And I'm always joking around about what's in that single text, you know, like, you know, what's the one thing, you know, that they were okay disclosing?
Right. I saw some speculation that maybe it was multiple devices, that for one device, there was nothing recovered, but on a personal device or a second government device, that there was one message. But that was speculation. We don't know.
Yep. I just want to touch on that for one second, because this is a, you know, the text messages are a Secret Service issue, right? But additionally, you know, at the time, Tony Ornato was also using White House small devices issued by the White House Communication Agency.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think it's in, like, again, this goes to the totality of this matter is not being fully disclosed. And what we're getting is very siloed information that we're not able to thread together. I also want to know, you know, on that day, if the focus is on Tony, which I, you know, have every reason to believe that it is, he was not communicating on his Secret Service phone. He was communicating on a White House communication agency phone as required by the Executive Office of the President. You know, and so were those records subpoenaed? Were those text messages subpoenaed? Do they have those messages, those communications? Because if he was communicating on a separate device that was not part of that data migration in technological transfer, if he was texting somebody within the service, we'll have that record. Again, I don't think hope is, you know, fully lost on trying to understand what type of communication there mm-hmm. was on that day, but it's becoming more complicated with this criminal investigation that we're not able to quickly, the service isn't able to sit agents down right now, get sworn affidavits. It now, because it's a criminal investigation, those agents have rights. They're going to have to go through their attorney. This is going to be a long game, not a quick adjudication.
Yeah. Juliet, I want to turn to you on a specific aspect of this that was just raised. So Tony Ornato is, you know, an assistant director of the U.S. Secret Service and was heading the security detail for the president, but takes a position in the executive office of the White House as a deputy chief of staff. That is not the source of all of the Secret Service's issues, but it certainly does cross some lines. We do have legislation that bans an active duty military officer from turning right around and becoming Secretary of Defense, absent a waiver, which of course has become the rage in recent administrations to grant such waivers. But is it time for something similar with the Secret Service, for legislation that says, absent a waiver, people within the Secret Service, perhaps of a certain level, but maybe the whole organization, must have, in a sense, a cooling off period before taking any other position, certainly within the White House itself?
Well, yes, something along those lines. I mean, this is the extent to which norms that everyone had agreed upon that didn't need to be regulated or formalized, that how successful Trump was at beating those down, right? And exposing that they were just norms, that if you got the right person who was willing to violate them, they'd be easily violated. I would have no problem as a member of the Secret Service leaving the Secret Service and going to work for the White House. They have skills that a White House would want. In particular, in this case, you know, you're sort of the COO of the White House. It's a complicated place with staff and all sorts of administrative needs. But you don't get to go back, and you don't get to retain that salary. This was the crazy part, that it was essentially a detail. Those are very rare. And if they're done, as we all know, in the national security arena, you know, Coast Guard goes over, CIA goes over. There's all sorts of rules about what role you're allowed to take, right? You're allowed to go to the NSC, but you're not going to be the comms director. And I think a perfectly good recent example is Kirby. John Kirby moving from the Pentagon to the White House, a much more political role at the White House. He's gone from the Pentagon as comms person. You don't get to stay. And so I think that would be an easy rule, right? In other words, if you're taking a job that's in the political beast as compared to the more career staff of the national security staff, that's fine. So, and I think I agree with everything that everyone said, except for maybe the belief that, you know, Tony is not all the problem. Tony's a big part of the problem, which is the agency. First of all, allowing him to do it was just reflective of an agency that catered to Trump in a way that they shouldn't have. And also remember, there's a DHS secretary who's a buffoon at this stage and catering to Trump as well. But I think the agency believes that by protecting him, he's back at the agency, they are in some way protecting the agency. And like, they need to pull that Band-Aid too, right? In other words, whatever he did in the name of the agency needs to be exposed for the agency to move forward. And let me put it one last thing. It isn't like, oh, they picked a guy to go be deputy chief of staff. Ornato is, from every person who's ever met him, I've talked to a lot of Secret Service, he's like, you know, uber MAGA, like he's a hot mess of MAGA, right? And why he's allowed to come back to Secret Service in a training position is a deep, deep problem. But once again, this is the Secret Service thinking, well, if we can just protect him, we're protecting ourselves. And once again, treat him like an agency that creates, you know, that's making widgets. And this is an easy problem. Yeah. You've got a personnel problem.
But you know what's interesting? So there's a couple of things there I just want to touch on. Like when this issue of Tony going into the administration, you know, this is an easy thing to shift off of the Secret Service again, but they need to get out in front of it. I mean, all that was it's allowable under the senior executive service under the Office of Personnel Management, right? This, you could call it manipulation of the rules or just adhering to the rules, but this was allowable. And so now you have to go back and say, like, all right, how do you prevent that from happening again, right? Like, what are those thresholds that don't allow somebody to get into a political position within an administration as opposed to either a more tactical position within an administration? What are those guardrails moving forward? Let's address that because you can't litigate the past. We should look at towards the future, make sure it doesn't happen again. But I think when you describe Tony here, it's amazing because I've heard that representation of him time and time again. But, you know, and I want to be fair here. I worked with Tony for years. I worked with him on the detail in multiple capacities. And when I was on the detail, it wasn't a Republican-led administration. It was Democratic-led administration. And Tony had a lot of dedication and focus as the head of protection operations, as a shift leader, which is a very key responsibility within the detail for Obama. I never saw him waver, like ever. So that drastic shift in just a few quick years into what many people have described, I haven't talked to him in years, so I can't give a firsthand account. So I will say that this is secondhand, but very, very descriptive to what you described. How did that happen so quickly? What were those influences? And I think that that's something we need to look at, because that wasn't what he was or the person that I knew him as. And I think that, again, is that an issue within the service? Is that an issue within government as a whole? I think that that's a conversation that should be had.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a long line of men that, you know, are before and afters, everyone from Giuliani to the White House physician. I mean, you know, wait a second, is that the person I thought I knew? All of them, you know, different levels. And then all of a sudden, you know, whether they were taken advantage of or liked what they saw, and it was more akin to who they were, you know, come in and perform in ways that you and I wouldn't recognize. I mean, think about the White House physician. What's his name? The congressman now.
Ronny Jackson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask about a morale issue, and I'll bounce this back to you from your time on the detail. I've got to think that right now, with the text crisis going on, with all of these questions that we've been talking about here, that it's got to be really tough on the job every day, because in part, some people in the service are looking at their colleagues and wondering, are these people who deleted text messages inappropriately? Are these people who you have to have the trust and confidence of your colleagues to do this job well? That's true in many organizations. I would say it's essential in the Secret Service. My experience with the Secret Service, both at CIA and at the State Department when I interacted with officers, was that these were people of high integrity who worked very well as a unit. Yes, there were some difficult personalities because we're all human beings, but they were very dedicated to the mission. And morale was something I never thought about when it came to actually executing job duties on the part of the agents I worked with. But it seems to me that right now you've got a very different situation. You've got a morale situation that's beyond something like Cartagena with people behaving badly when going overseas. You've got a situation where you are on the job driving a protectee down the street and you're wondering what the people around you are doing, what they've done, whether they're the target of a criminal investigation or not. Talk through what that does to somebody on the job that you were on, how that gets in your head and can affect the actual performance of the job duties.
Well, you know, it's disturbing to think about, first of all, David. But I think that those that I have spoken to, and I speak to agents who are currently on the detail or formerly on the detail multiple times a day, I think that's less of a concern for them in terms of consequence. I think it's a lower priority of consequence. The greatest priority right now is, and you touched upon this, is the trust and confidence, but the trust and confidence of our protectees. Right. Yeah. And this is something I faced directly after the Cartagena issue with the First Lady, Valerie Jarrett, the president. Whenever the Secret Service has any type of, you know, credibility issue facing them, that has a direct impact on how protectees view us and the level of cooperation they give us, because they're wondering, wait a second, what are these women and men doing? What are their competencies? How can I trust them? How can I trust, you know, with them with my children? Those are the bigger factors. And I think that weighs very heavily on agents because they need to do a job in the moment of like a real tactical issue. They need to execute on their job nearly flawlessly in terms of how to, like, the process. And I think what's really interesting today is we're seeing a tale of two services, right? We're seeing, like, in just two issues. If I take the text messages and the Tony issue on one side and the way that the vice president's detail did react, you know, during the insurrection at the Capitol, at Capitol Hill, we're seeing, you know, two drastically different viewpoints. We are seeing the agents who were on the vice president's detail actually following the protocol, actually doing what they've been trained to do, focused on, you know, the tactical and relocation aspects of the principal in a deteriorating environment. And I think that the radio transmission, well, I pushed back very hard that they were scared or that they were calling their loved ones. Mm-hmm. I think that's just ridiculous. It was a tense situation. I mean, you had agents that were trying to figure out the window of relocating that vice president at that moment in time was rapidly closing. And the pathways that they needed to go down, you heard, like, there was smoke deployed. We don't know what type of smoke. So now I have to make an immediate risk calculation. Do I bring my protectee through a smoke-filled environment where I don't know if that is a chemical, biological, you know, hazard that I'm – so you never want to go from one destabilized environment into another. So they're doing that consequence calculation like real time. And I think for the first time, the public really saw that they're doing it with masks on because of COVID. So there were a lot of stressors that were ongoing, but what did they do? They actually, you know, got the vice president to the right location. No one was injured none of the protectees were injured. And then they were able to go to that quick area of refuge and then hold. Really, that's supposed to be just a quick check. It took a few hours where the president was in the loading dock area. He was secure, the staff was secure, and his family were secure. You saw all of that, but that's practiced. That is trained upon. The agents, you relied upon their training, tactics, and experience to do that. I thought that was a big success. On the other side, you see these stumbles, these missteps, these administrative, you know, hiccups, the non-disclosure. Why? Because administration of the agency is so anomalous for people, right? And I think it's that is always the difficulty for the service, is how do they govern themselves? It has been, you know, for a long time. And, you know, that's why we're really seeing this drastic viewpoint of an agency. One works well under tactical pressure, but under administrative pressure, it has difficulties.
You really lay out that the motto of the Secret Service, which is worthy of trust and confidence. You had two very different takes on that. The Pence detail itself, worthy of trust and confidence, just from the insight that we've had, which is beyond what most of us get into an actual crisis situation for the service. Absolutely worthy of trust and confidence, the way they handled that situation. the rest of the organization and the things we're learning about it and the way it handles a crisis, I share your concern that the trust and confidence that's necessary to do the job, to uphold the stated values of the Secret Service of duty, justice, courage, honesty, and loyalty, this is at great risk now. Juliet, let's close with you. This text crisis, as we'll call it, it could go in multiple directions from here. And you've talked a bit about what you would like to see the organization do, but let's talk about what it does within the Department of Homeland Security itself. As you know better than most of us, DHS is kind of a patchwork quilt of different agencies, departments, bureaus, et cetera, that have very different missions. But it is historically one of the cabinet level departments of the last 20 years that has had the lowest morale overall.
Yes.
Apart from this scandal, what does this mean for DHS and for the ability of other organizations that have come under fire in recent years within the department to pull themselves together? And I guess what I'm getting at is the bigger question of, is this further evidence for people who want it that
to go back at Treasury?
Yeah, that the Department of Homeland Security is just a flawed home for some of these, and we need to do, in a sense, another reorg and get some agencies and departments out of there.
Well, it's interesting. So I'm of the school that, like, either commit to the department or do it now. But 20 years of debating this is a little bit too long. So long ago, I was like, should FEMA be here or not? FEMA should be, is here, Secret Service here or not? Secret Service is here. So like, that's, give me the world as it is, not as I want it to be. And I'm not sure, at least on this crisis, that the moving of the deck chairs would actually change it. Previous reviews of the Secret Service, when it's found itself in scandals, when it was under Treasury, had the same complaint that Treasury was too hands off of the Secret Service as DHS has been. So I'll tell you, this is what I write about. So components have been reformed in the past. So FEMA after Hurricane Katrina is now the FEMA of Hurricane Sandy. It's not perfect. We certainly saw that with Hurricane Maria, but I think a lot of that had to do with the administration. But I think, the less we talk about FEMA, the happier we are. And that ends up being good. The TSA of the long lines of the summer of 15, that there was 14 that we then, bring in Pete Neffinger. And you reform it, and now people, we complain about air travel for a variety of reasons now, but it tends not to be the security lines, and we fix a lot of this. So I believe these agencies can be reformed while they're doing their important mission, and I think the department can do it. One of the benefits of the Secret Service being unique, and now I'll give credit where credit is due, it has a very unique mission. It isn't making widgets, is that you can also isolate the damage. And so my sense talking to other people at DHS is that they can isolate this scandal from its sort of core operations, where I don't think that was possible with, say, the separation of children or Hurricane Katrina, like the big scandals that hit DHS. But I do think that this is a leadership opportunity for Ali Mayorkas, who's a friend who I really like. I think I don't get what political strategy is keeping him not at the forefront. I think it's an opportunity for him to assert control over a component that's his. And I'm just assuming that there's some calculation about why that's not happening more publicly, and it might be happening more privately.
Well, because I have such a strong feeling that we are not done with this situation, I will say that we will not stop. We will press pause on this and resume this when we know more. Juliet, John, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, David. I appreciate it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Remember to get ad-free versions of this and some other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. Rate and review us wherever you find your podcasts, and spread the word to family and friends about this and the entire suite of Lawfare audio products, including The Aftermath, looking at the issues of January 6th and the investigations into it, Rational Security, Chatter, Live from Ukraine, and Noble. This podcast is edited by Jen Pacha-Howell. Your audio engineer this time was me. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.